Now with us is Flora Lichtman, our video pick of the week, our multimedia editor. Now, Flora has been very busy out there, also filming not cattle, but...
another local icon. Well, a man, Malcolm Beck, who studies something slightly more unsavory, I would say.
Unsavory?
Yeah, although I'm a total convert now. He's a guru of compost.
Compost?
Yes.
A guru of compost.
He has been driving the compost train for 50 years. He started doing compost, this compost business. And if you live in San Antonio, you might know of Gardenville. It sounds like people in the crowd do know about it. So it's a organic farming and gardening center, and he's the guy who started it over 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. And he was an organic farmer, you know, in a time when it wasn't quite as trendy. And he said that when he started his compost business, people hadn't even heard the word.
Mm-hmm. This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow with Flora Lichtman talking about the king of compost.
That's even better than compost guru.
The king of compost. and you went out, and it's on our video pick of the week up on our website at sciencefriday.com. You watched these piles of compost and that he collects and he makes.
40 acres of compost processing. They're these big, giant mounds of, you know, black manure and other stuff.
I couldn't have said it any better or any safer. there's an aha moment in your video, because when you look at these black mounds of manure... And he says his most prized manure comes from what?
This is amazing. From bat guano. That's like the really good stuff. It gets packaged separately. It's the gold standard of compost, apparently. And it's from Bracken Cave here in San Antonio.
Bat guano. And he's got these mounds and mounds of it. But what he won't tell most people is the secret he told you.
Yes.
I hope no one's listening, because it's a secret.
This is the secret life of compost. Here it is. How do you know when compost is done? Because, you know, the basic mixture is carbon, wood chips, and then a manure, a poop source. Let's just say it.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you know it's done? You stick your hand in it, and you take it to your nose, and you take a big sniff. And if it doesn't smell so manure-y, then it's done. He actually said, find a woman because they have a more acute sense of smell. So Catherine, our arts producer,
for all the excuses I've heard about find a woman, sniffing bat manure or whatever, it's got to be delayed. But the thing also about bat manure that he told you is that it's not really bat manure, is it?
Oh, yes. So this is the other aha moment. The bat guano fertilizer is actually beetle poop, because it's the beetles that break down this bat guano in this cave, and so that's what they're literally vacuuming out of the cave. Beetle poop is the bat guano manure.
So that's really not even his high-quality stuff.
Ira, I feel like you're outing him or something.
No, I think it's really fascinating.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. And he sells it in bags and people take it away.
Yeah, I think he ships it all over the place. And there are different varieties. In fact, you know, I think the different manure comes from different places. The San Antonio sewer system, for example. The zoo stables. You know, what...
Zoo-doo.
What's...
They used to sell zoo-doo. Yeah, they used to have zoo-doo out there from the zoos, yeah.
But it's like a recycling plant. I mean, this guy really is doing an amazing thing. He's taking a lot of garbage and turning it into plant food.
And he'll ship it anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
So he bags it
up. Check the website.
That's it. Go to our website. It could be a great holiday gift, you know.
Local.
It's local product. You know, it's useful. Really good compost is the best soil in the world. You know, you guys, farmers and ranchers, you put your hands in the great compost, and it really is wonderful stuff. And if you go to our website at sciencefriday.com, you can watch Flora and her visit out there to watch how he processes all this manure and compost.
And if you live in San Antonio, it's definitely worth going to have a look at his place. He's got a test garden. It's a cool operation.
There you go. Now, if you needed something to do for the weekend, you can go out and visit, pick up a bag of it for yourself. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
That's about all the time we have for this hour. Our program's senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Intagliata, Catherine Wells, Alessio Bayak. Sam Flatow is our production assistant. Our intern is Ian Chant. Neil Rauch is our technical director, and he's at the controls here in San Antonio. Engineer Carlos Asensio is here with us in San Antonio. Sean Phillips is our engineer in Washington. Peter Granitz is directing from D.C. If you missed any part of our program, you can go to iTunes. Yeah, go to iTunes and subscribe to our podcast. You can actually subscribe to the video podcast, too, and our audio podcast. And if you have an iPhone or an Android, you can download the app and have them sent to you without even worrying and wondering and having to download it all the time and go right to you. We'd like to say goodbye this hour from Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow in San Antonio.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. The guys are heading into the barbershop. They've got a lot on their minds, including that dust-up between popular radio personality Tom Joyner and his old friends, talk show host Tavis Smiley and scholar Cornel West. We'll talk about why Joyner thinks that Smiley and West are actually to blame for some of the rude remarks directed at the president. But first, we are going to talk about some bad news about the economy. Today's report from the Labor Department showed only 18,000 new jobs were added in June. That edged the unemployment rate up to 9.2%. And this month marks 2 years from what we were told was the end of the recession. President Obama talked about this in brief remarks today.
There are bills and trade agreements before Congress right now that could get all these ideas moving. All of them have bipartisan support. All of them could pass immediately. And I urge Congress not to wait. The American people need us to do everything we can to help strengthen this economy and make sure that we are producing more jobs.
Here to give us the big picture on these low jobs numbers, Marilyn Geewax, NPR senior business editor. She's with us once again in our studios in Washington. Marilyn, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Hi, nice to be here.
Now, you know, on the face of it, the unemployment rate edging up a tenth of a percent from 9.1% to 9.2%, bad, doesn't sound that bad, but you're saying it's actually more significant than the numbers would appear. Tell us why.
When you dig around in these numbers, everything is bad. Wages were down. Temporary workers got hurt. Job creation was really sluggish. It was just so far below what you'd want to see this far into the recovery. Remember, Michelle, that we are now exactly 2 years into what is supposed to be this recovery. Starting in June of 2009, the economy began growing. So if the economy is growing, we should be adding jobs. We should be pretty far along now. Well, in June of 2009, the unemployment rate was 9.5%, and now we're at 9.2%. Wow, you know, 2 years of expansion, and all you've gotten is to drop the unemployment rate from 9.5 to 9.2. That's awful.
And you were also saying that that's also the psychological effect of this also is that people were expecting a lot more in part because
yes.
of certain events that you would have thought would have led to job creation.
Well, you know, there was a sense out there that the jobs were going to be picking up again in June because we had had some sort of big shocks that happened in this spring. Remember, obviously, gas prices shot up. We went really quickly up in gas prices to almost $4 a gallon in early May. So that set people back. But we also had other setbacks in the spring. If Fukushima, the terrible events in Japan where we had a tsunami, an earthquake, and all those supply disruptions, that was bound to ripple out into some of our manufacturing in this country. So that was a bad event in March. But April was a terrible weather month. You know, we had a lot of those tornadoes, flooding. It was still tough in early May. So here we get to June, and it's pretty balmy. Gas prices have eased back. We're down to about $3.60 a gallon. Now, that's not cheap. Admittedly, that's a lot more than last summer, but still, it's down from the peaks, and psychologically, that should have helped. The Fukushima thing is starting to work itself out. And all of that bad weather, the tornadoes, you would think that by now there would be a bump up, a stimulus effect from that, because you have to rebuild those homes, you have to clean up from all of that debris. So where is it? You know, there's kind of almost a mystery to this economy, that you keep thinking that the jobs report should be getting better. And I think we can turn to any one of the 14.1 million Americans who don't have jobs right now, and they can assure you that it's just not happening. We're not getting the job growth.
Now, we mentioned earlier that the president is going to meet again this Sunday with the congressional leadership to talk about, you know, how they can come to agreement on the federal budget. As we mentioned earlier, the congressional Republicans have said that they won't vote to raise the debt ceiling unless there's a broader agreement over the federal budget and reducing the deficit. Do you think that the lack of a deal on this bigger issue is somehow affecting job creation?
Yes, you almost have to think that there's something out there that is eroding confidence, because it shouldn't be this bad. We should be adding jobs. You look at a lot of statistics and you would think, well, geez, we should be moving forward, but we're not. And what is that problem? And I think that one could make a pretty reasonable argument that businesses are not hiring because there's a lack of confidence out there. They don't know quite what's going to happen. I mean, what if we really did have a government default? I mean, that would be, many economists believe it would be catastrophic. The impact on interest rates would be huge. So people are pretty worried about that.
And we're also getting mixed signals about whether the two sides are, in fact, closer to an agreement or not. I'll just play a short clip from a news conference at the Capitol today that included House Speaker John Boehner. Here he is.
There is no agreement in private or in public. And as the president said yesterday, we are this far apart. It's not like there's some imminent deal about to happen. There are serious disagreements about how to deal with this very serious problem.
As I mentioned, we're speaking with NPR's senior business editor, Marilyn Geewax, and we're talking about the unemployment numbers that came out today. Not good numbers. So how do you think this would factor into it? I mean, obviously, I think the Republicans would say, not that I speak for them, but I think that they would say that if there is an agreement to bring down the deficit, that would be a stimulus to the economy because it would give business confidence.
Right. I think that the thing about businesses is, generally speaking, they can cope with almost anything as long as they know what anything is. They just need some sense of confidence about where are we going with this. Let's get it done so that they can make their plans. For example, some of the things that President Obama has talked about that would be part of a deal here. Corporate jet tax breaks. And he wants to change the way corporate jets are depreciated, and that would potentially harm that industry. Well, if you're in Kansas and you have a plant where you're making corporate jets, you could probably cope with the news one way or the other, but not knowing if those those deductions were going to change the depreciation schedule, it puts you in a very awkward position. You don't know what's going to happen.
And finally, Marilyn, the president referred to some ideas that he says are ready to go. What are some of those ideas?
Well, he wants some things like these trade agreements that have been kicking around for a while. He'd like to get that done, again, back to this uncertainty thing. One way or the other, do the trade deals or don't do them. There's payroll tax cuts. He wants them extended. Are we going to do that or aren't we? So there are many questions out here where Congress, just if they would give people certainty, I think employers could move ahead.
Marilyn Geewax is our senior business editor and one of our frequent contributors on jobs and the economy. Marilyn, thanks so much for joining us.
Always nice to be here.
During the early days of the space race, only governments had deep enough pockets to send humans into orbit. Now commercial ventures are poised to pick up where the shuttle program leaves off. And what will that do to our image of space? Our film critic Bob Mondello knows, because Hollywood has already boldly gone where no company has gone before.
When I was a kid, years before the first space shuttle went into orbit, I knew what outer space was going to be like. I'd seen it at the movies. It was just like Earth, only weightless. In 2001, A Space Odyssey, to get to a space station, characters flew Pan Am. If you're under 30, ask your parents. And once they'd arrived there, apart from curved walls and floors, everything was familiar. You could check into a Hilton, chow down at Howard Johnson's, even check up on the youngsters back home by calling them from a Bell Telephone picture phone booth.
Hello! Hello. How are you, Squirt?
Hello.
What are you doing?
Hey.
Phone booths in the sky seemed less likely by the time NASA had flown the first real shuttle mission in 1981. By then, silent running had shown us a future in which corporate spaceships were essentially lifeboats from a planet so wrecked the Earth's few remaining plants had to be shepherded to safety in outer space. American Airlines space freighters took them there in geodesic domes in hopes that they would someday be able to return.
Until that day, may God bless these goddesses.
Great plan, except that after a while, the airline wanted its freighters back.
We have just received orders to abandon and nuclear destruct all the forests and return our ships to commercial service.
A company putting profit first? How could that be? Actually, greedy space corporations became a Hollywood staple. In the Alien movies, the Weyland-Yutani Corporation really wants one of those diabolical aliens and doesn't want to hear about consequences.
We sat down there on company orders to get this thing, which destroyed my crew and your expensive ship.
Thank you, Officer Ripley. That will be all.
Please, you're not listening to me.
In space, no one can hear you sacrificing humanity for profit. About that same moment, and remember this is still before NASA had put a shuttle into orbit, James Bond was tracking down a hijacked space shuttle and discovering that the guy who'd had it hijacked was the industrialist who'd made it, the evil head of the Drax Corporation.
That's where the Moonraker shuttle is made?
That's right.
I'd heard that Hugo Drax is obsessed with the conquest of space. Now I can believe it.
As a rule, if you like the notion of privatizing outer space, you probably want to steer clear of the multiplex, where starships run by federations and republics tend to be good. Corporate starships, not so much. The by and large megacorp in WALL-E, for instance, evacuating Earth because it had turned the planet into a trash heap.
Too much garbage in your face? There's plenty of space out in space. B&L Starliners leaving each day. We'll clean up the mess while you're away.
Then there was Lunar Industries in the film Moon, economizing while reaping huge profits.
Gertie, have you heard anything new about anyone fixing Lunar Sat?
No, Sam. What I understand is it's fairly low on the company's priority list right now.
And, of course, the RDA Mining Corporation in Avatar, trying to get its hands on a precious resource by military means.
Back on Earth, these guys were army dogs, marines, fighting for freedom. But out here, they just hired guns. Taking the money, working for the company.
There's more, but who needs to zoom into outer space to know the profit motive can lead to greed? It was, after all, the not-for-profit status of NASA's shuttle that's kept it above the fray since its maiden voyage. And in retirement, well, Hollywood's not even giving it a chance to cool its jets. In the film Another Earth, opening in just 2 weeks, a fictional shuttle will be owned not by NASA, but by a space tourism company. Seems pretty benign. Guess we'll see. I'm Bob Mondello.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. Think back to the days when the space shuttle had yet to blast off for the first time. In 1977, NASA tested the Enterprise to prove the shuttle could fly and land.
For 33 miles, the shuttle will glide and fly alone about 9 nautical miles on north. It'll start to make a big turn up by the Atchison and Topeka Railway.
How quaint now to imagine a shuttle simply gliding over railways. The U.S. space program has come so far, and today is bittersweet for the millions of people who have been inspired by it. Adam Frank is one of them. He's been following the U.S. space program for decades. Frank is an astrophysicist and blogger for NPR, and he has these reflections on the day that the last space shuttle blasted off.
Back in 1972, the library in my hometown wasn't very big, but its size didn't matter much to my 10-year-old sensibilities. That was the year I discovered their collection on the U.S. space program. Those few books were big enough to help change my life. I spent the whole summer poring over images taken by NASA astronauts and space probes, and I decided one day, no matter what, I was going to be a scientist too. Recently, I've been asking astronomers what inspired them as kids. The answers they give are all the same. From graduate students to full professors, their first scientific inspiration was the U.S. space program. if the researchers are older than me, their eyes light up with memories of watching John Glenn stuffed into a tiny Mercury capsule getting blown into Earth orbit, or seeing the first grainy close-up images of Mars beamed back from Mariner 4's 1965 flyby of the Red Planet. If they're younger, their voices quicken with memories of shuttle astronauts on heroically long spacewalks repairing the wounded Hubble Space Telescope. Always, it was the U.S. space program that lit a fire in their kid imaginations and launched them onto scientific trajectories. This effect isn't limited to astronomers. Dig below the surface of many scientifically trained American adults, and you'll find a bunch of kids who caught the science bug from the U.S. space program. So what happens now? We're facing a years-long gap before NASA can put its own astronauts into space. Without the roar of space shuttle launches, are we facing an inspiration gap too? What's going to inspire the next generation of students to a life in science? Reorienting a space program drifting from a lack of clear direction and a lack of funds is the right thing to do. So is supporting the fledgling private space industry. Real-world budget pressures might defer the truly thrilling goals, like seeing human beings clamber over the red hills of Mars, forever. The loss of that dream would feel terrible to the 10-year-old I was all those years ago. More importantly, it would be a terrible loss for all the 10-year-olds dreaming now of exploration and science. And for a nation that needs science and scientists to survive, it would be the most terrible loss of all. Inspiration is difficult to measure and even more difficult to price. But as I've seen, it's the root of our excellence in science. Right now, there's a frozen moon called Europa orbiting Jupiter. It has a surface of ice that is miles thick. Below that ice is a liquid ocean that goes even deeper. Who knows what unimagined ecosystems might thrive in those oceans? Someday, somebody who is inspired now as a kid is going to wander those frozen plains and drill down to explore those oceans. If we are smart in our choices, then those kids could still be our own.
Adam Frank is a professor of astrophysics at the University of Rochester. He also writes for the NPR blog 13.7 Cosmos and Culture.